All right, good evening.
Oh, that does sound better, doesn't it?
We are going to take one more look into virtue tonight and look at it from the perspective of practice. You know, there's two ways you can look at everything, at least from my perspective, two ways you can look at everything that shows up in Dhamma. One is to begin to kind of contemplatively understand the nature of whatever that is that you're looking at, whatever the object is that you want to see. And the other way to look at it is through practice. And when I say practice, I'm talking about in the body. I'm talking about an embodiment of whatever Dhamma you're looking at. It's we can listen to talks, we can read about it, we can do all these things about understanding and studying the Dhamma. And on one sense, we have all these teachers, we listen, we read and study and kind of look into it, and it all comes from outside of us. You know, it all comes from something that somebody else said or something that I read somewhere or some, you know, retreat I went to and some teacher, some experience I had with a teacher. But the other aspect of Dhamma is purely practice. It's purely embodied. It is the wisdom that arises from your own experience. And that wisdom that arises from your own experience has very little to do with anything anybody says or anything anybody can teach you, anything you read. It has very little to do with outside of you. There's a famous monk named Ajahn Mun who is he's a Thai forest monk. And one day I was at IMS. I can't remember what I was at IMS for. Oh, it was my first retreat ever. And I, you know, at the end of the retreat at IMS, they have all these books out. And I didn't have hardly any money. I barely had enough money to pay for the whole thing. And so when I went into so you've been on this retreat, you're all open, you're all in a, you know, this sense of awe and wonderment. And you go out into the dining hall and there are all these books you could buy. And I wanted every one of those books. Every time I would look at a book, I'd say, oh, I want that, I want that. But I didn't have any money. And so, thankfully, for the people like me, there is a Dhana table. So you go over and there's the Dhana books and you can just get one of these books. And so I picked up this book about the autobiography of Ajahn Mun. And I didn't think anything of it. It was just sitting there. I picked it up, took it home with me, and began to read about this guy and his life. He lived back in the 1920s, and he did not study Buddhism. He didn't study like we study Buddhism. He didn't do that. He became a novice, and then he went into the forest, and he sat, and he walked, and he sat. And he walked, and he sat, and that was it. And he became this fierce, beloved monk with this deep well of wisdom for no other reason than because he saw the truth of the Dhamma. So some of what I'm going to talk about, that's what I'm hoping, that's the way we can look at it. Like you are Ajahn Mun, and whatever you learn from the practice of virtue, you learn it for yourself. And it has very little to do with what I say. And so all I want to do is give you three practices that you could try to help increase that sort of attention towards virtue. But before I do that, one more thing. Lest we get into this thought that we could somehow or another make ourselves virtuous. You know, we have a way in the West of thinking that we can make ourselves be something. And I want to use this, share this little story with you to kind of help cut that off at the pass. When we were at Blodell Hall, Rodney did a series on the Brahmaviharas. And of course, by the time I got towards the end of the series, I wanted to be a walking Brahmaviharian. I just wanted to exude loving kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity. I just wanted to just flow out of me wherever I went. And so I began to try to sort of be these different qualities. And it wasn't working very well. In fact, I noticed the opposite mostly. Trying to be loving kindness and I'm mad all the time. Trying to have compassion, I'm just irritated with people. Trying to have joy and I'm jealous. See what I'm saying? So I asked Rodney one day during the question and answer period, I asked him, I said, I know that, you know, these qualities of the Brahmaviharas arise on their own. But how can I cultivate the environment so they're more likely to arise? And that moment in time was so important for my future development as a practitioner. I had no idea. But Rodney's answer was, Tuari, there's wisdom in your question and ignorance. And when he said the word ignorance, I didn't hear anything else. That's all I heard was my name in association with the word ignorance, and it all stopped. But really, what Rodney helped me understand in that answer that he gave was that the idea that we can make something happen is the problem. If we could learn to trust that our practice, our embodiment, our seeking into is sufficient for the arising of this virtuous conduct, we would save ourselves a lot of heartache. So hopefully, the way I'm hoping I can talk about this in such a way that you can begin to see that you're not trying to be virtuous. You're trying to create not so much the environment for virtue to arise, but it's more of just creating a sort of connection with this idea of the embodiment of virtue. So, three ways you can do this. These were all the commentaries that I looked at about this. One, it seems like a lot of the commentaries point towards this kind of avoidance practice. We avoid the practice of avoidance. And when I mean the practice of avoidance, I'm talking about practices like the precepts. Because the precepts are not a practice of something as much as it is the avoidance of something. In the precepts, the main thrust of it is undertaking the training to refrain from doing something. We're undertaking a practice to not do something, to avoid some behavior. And all of this behavior, I guess for me, comes towards one thing, and that's harmful conduct. So everything in as I see this ultimate idea of practicing around virtue, we are ultimately trying to do no harm. Trying in some respects to do no harm. And the more we start practicing around the embodiment of virtue, the more harm we see that we actually do. So in some respects, the more you practice with the virtue, the more you're going to see the actual non-virtuous conduct that we live out of a lot. I think that's why we can't get caught up in the idea that we could make ourselves virtuous. Because if we try to make ourselves something and we see that we are not, we can, in effect, cause ourselves more harm, more discouragement, instead of actually seeing that the fact we see how virtuous we are not is actually the gift of virtue. So we start with this idea of avoidance practice. We avoid, or we undertake the training to refrain from killing, but I've also heard it said that we refrain from causing harm to another living being, any living being. So we are trying to contemplate or trying to avoid causing harm. Undertake the training to not take that which is not freely offered. Or in our speech, we're undertaking the training to refrain from or avoid harmful speech, sexual misconduct, and abusing intoxicants or like drugs or alcohol. Actually, I heard someone said that one teacher taught us that it was more like the anything that causes heedlessness. So if you're someone like me, I don't really drink and I don't take any drugs, I have to watch my television consumption and food and sugar consumption, things like that, because that is where I will get caught in the heedlessness. So if you start looking at this idea of refraining from, undertaking a training to refrain from, you can see a couple of things here. I used to only do the precepts when I was going on retreat. So right before, like we do them every year here, and then when I was on a retreat, then I would do the precepts. But if you start actually doing the precepts as an intentional practice, you can start seeing some things. That when you actually say that you're going to undertake the training to refrain from doing something, it actually points to your intentional content. It's your intention, your motivation before you do something. It's the motivation behind all of our actions, or I should say, in front of all of our actions. Gil Fronstahl said that our intentions, noticed or unnoticed, gross or subtle, contribute either to our suffering or to our happiness. Intentions are sometimes called seeds. The garden you grow depends on the seeds you plant and water. Long after a deed is done, the trace or momentum of the intention behind it remains as a seed, conditioning our future happiness or unhappiness. So in some respects, our intentions, the real thrust behind all of our deeds, all of our actions, all of our thoughts, that is what sets the groundwork as to whether or not our conduct has the potential of being virtuous or harmful. And so we're trying to pay attention to those seeds. And in order to pay attention to the seeds, that practice of repeating the precepts on a regular basis is actually pointing towards our intentions. It's actually a pointing towards an avoidance practice. You are avoiding harmful behavior by paying attention to the intentions behind or in front of your conduct. I mean, you think of it as the intentions behind your conduct, but I keep having a problem here because when I think of the word intention, it's what precedes whatever our conduct is. And so an avoidance practice is more about an intention practice, what our intentions are around behavior. So another way to think about it is, everybody in this room has learned how to adjust their behaviors. We know how to watch our aggressiveness and kind of, you know, watch our talk so we sound nice. We know how to watch our behavior so we're not overly aggressive. We come across being very nice. Don't actually do any kind of sexual harm. We watch our intake of alcohol and drugs and pay attention to these kinds of things. We kind of have learned how to adjust our behavior so that our behavior fits within this social norm. And we all come across as looking quite righteous, very nice, very kind people. But we know that's not really what's going on the inside. There's a little bit of an edge that goes on. It's just that nobody can really see that part. And that is the part that avoidance practice is touching into. The part of us that is not the nice part, outward conduct, but the intention of the real kind of much more hateful, harmful, meaner, crueler intentions that are behind a lot of our conduct. No matter how nice we are on the outside, the precepts are pointed more towards that intentional behavior that we try not to see. So if I remember practicing with the precepts every day, went through this period of time where every day I would get up and I would say the five precepts as part of my morning ritual, I probably noticed more of my unskillful and more harmful intentions behind my behavior during that period than in any other period of time that I've ever practiced. Because every time you say that you're undertaking this training, it's a very soft thing that we say. We're undertaking this training. There's no stick pointed at you that says you better not do this or you better watch that or, you know, good, be good or don't be good. There's none of that. It's a very soft kind of undertaking this training to refrain from doing something. And because it's so soft and it's couched in such a kind way, it's much easier to see the harshness of our harmful intentions. It's much easier to see that harmfulness against the backdrop of an otherwise softer, kinder practice. So if you want to practice in this idea of avoiding unskillful conduct or avoiding harmful behavior, practice the precepts and say them over and over and over so that you can see for yourself where the line is. The second type of virtue practice that you can do is performance. It's called, it's the performance of virtue. I guess I would think of this as more of the actual act of our conduct, our actual actions. And so we can practice looking at our actual conduct, both around our speech. It's the part of the Eightfold Path in the middle, our right speech, right conduct, right livelihood. You look at your actual behavior. So if you think of the precepts as a contemplative practice that helps you see into your intentions, then the practice of the performance practice on virtue is more of the actual movement, our movement in our behaviors, our actual conduct. So here you notice both the conduct that you do that is skillful and wholesome, but you also notice the conduct that you do that's not skillful or that's not harmful, and you make amends when you see it. So the act of skillful conduct or wholesome conduct, that which is virtuous in and of itself, and the noticing of unskillful conduct, unwholesome conduct, conduct that leads to harm, it is the same if you make amends. You can begin to see that whether you do something skillful or not, it is in the making amends when you see that your conduct is not skillful. So for a long time when I started practicing, I mean, all these practices, like the Eightfold Path, I would spend, just take some time and say, okay, I'm just going to practice with the Eightfold Path and just stay with it day after day after day. And the one thing I could never understand with the Eightfold Path is why there was right speech separated out from the other precepts, even though right speech is also in the precepts. And several years ago, Greg Kramer did his first non-residential in Inside Dialogue. He did it up at Bastyr, and he did this talk around speech as conduct. I don't think I ever really thought of speech as conduct the way he talks about speech as conduct, but if we could see how much harm our speech actually causes, in fact, we could probably cause more harm out of our speech than our actual behavior. Even if we look at the level of harm we cause ourselves in our speech, we could begin to see just how harmful our conduct actually is. And if we could see how harmful our conduct was, we could make amends. How many times have you said horrific things to yourself and never once apologized. I mean, if I said some of the things that I said, that I say to myself, if I said it to someone else, I would apologize quickly. But when I think about what I say to myself, I never think to apologize to myself for what I say. Until I started listening to Greg's talk on conduct, speech as conduct. And when you think about speech as conduct, then your words are movement. Your words are the actual manifestation of some action. And it has a karmic implication to it. It has a consequence to it. Even in the words that I say to myself and I don't say out loud, there's a karmic implication to that, and there is a consequence to that of a setting a seed that will forever grow. So, when you start practicing in this idea of performance, then the idea would be that we would begin to pay attention to both our words, our thoughts, and our deeds. And when we notice that we do something skillful, wholesome, and non-harming, we take note of that. But when we notice that we do something unskillful, unwholesome, or that harms either ourselves or someone else, we make amends. And I had to start apologizing to myself a lot. I don't even think I had ever thought of the idea of apologizing to myself until I started practicing with this specific conduct of speech. At first, it could seem like you're doing more apologizing than you're doing anything else. Because it seems as though the only thing, I don't know, I think some of you guys might remember when Rodney used to say that he did this whole thing of writing down whenever he would tell a lie. I don't know if some of you guys may not remember, you may not have known, but Rodney, when he first started doing this, he did this, take on this speech, watching his speech, and he wanted to do right speech, and so he didn't want to lie. So every time he would tell a lie, he'd make a little note on a little piece of paper and remind himself. Well, first he said he wrote it down, and then it just got too much, so then he would just do Just a little lie. And I don't want to say his story wrong, but he was talking to, I think, one of his students. I think he was a teacher's aide, and I think he was talking to one of his students. And he said something that was a lie. So he pulled out this little book, and he wrote this little notch. And then the student said, "Well, what's that?" And he didn't want to tell the student that he had just lied, so he lied. He had to put another And he decided, that is not going to work. I never forgot that. Because when I first started paying attention to speech as conduct, and this idea that I would apologize to myself, I just seemed like I was forever apologizing. Like I didn't even notice that I was doing anything that was skillful. It just seemed like everything I was doing was unskillful. And then I begin to notice some things. For instance, I noticed that I only noticed when I was unskillful. It's as if I just sort of skipped over my skillful behavior, skillful way of talking to myself. I would just skip over it, and I only really noticed the unskillful behavior and started making amends to it. So it's important to notice when we do skillful behavior. It's important to notice when our conduct is wholesome. It's not just important to notice when we do something wrong or we do something harmful. It's important to notice that we did not harm anyone and that we actually are, naturally becoming more and more skillful, more and more wholesome in the way we relate to people, in the way that we relate to each other. Shantideva says, I don't even know if this actually fits, but I'm going to say it anyway because I like Shantideva. It is natural for the immature to harm others. Getting angry with them is like resenting fire for burning. See why I like him? It's so good. It's natural for the immature to harm others. Getting angry with them is like resenting fire for burning. It's sort of like that's what I, if you just change it a little bit, it's natural for us to harm others. Getting angry with ourselves is like resenting fire for burning. So it's sort of like it's beginning to see that you can begin to notice in the performance practice that you're seeing that the skillful behavior, the unskillful behavior, the wholesome behavior, the unwholesome behavior, or causing harm, not causing harm, all very natural, either way. And you just notice when you do skillful, non-harming, wholesome behavior, and you notice when you don't. And when you don't, you make amends to sort of straighten that up. It's not just our speech, though. It's also in looking at our livelihood. And for a long time, I was taught in the beginning that livelihood was really just about don't do any kind of job that had to do with weapons, poisons, intoxicants, trafficking in animals, or the killing of animals or trafficking in human beings. That was it. And so, you know, I'm a prosecutor, so I would always think to myself, does prosecutor fall on the line there? I mean, I am kind of working with people, and there is a bit of weapons that are always showing up in some crime somewhere. There was just always this sense of whether or not to be a prosecutor, you are in right livelihood or not right livelihood. And actually, Philip Moffat helped me understand in a conversation we had a long time ago about, in one of his non-residentials, it was more about seeing the balancing in life, you know? More about the scheming and the kind of conning, cheating your way through your job. That there was a way that we can belittle people and sort of try to get our way and prod and push around work that causes harm in and of itself, in whatever field we're working in. And so I begin to pay more attention, not so much to whether or not a prosecutor was an acceptable job or not, but whether or not I was going to be the kind of prosecutor that was going to, you know, scheme my way through or belittle other people or kind of push and prod and take advantage of something. The first time I actually came face to face with this was in a case where one of the, there was a man who was being held for a robbery in the first degree. And he, the victims of this crime told this unbelievable story about what happened. And just to make a long story short, basically what they said was this guy terrorized them and it was a horrible situation and that they finally got away with their life and limb and they made their way to, it was one woman. She made her way to this house. And when she got to this house, she wanted to call the police, but the homeowner wouldn't let her. And she was so upset, but the only thing the homeowner would let her do is call her friend. So she called her friend, and her friend came and picked her up. And that's why they called the police like 3 or 4 hours after this so-called robbery. Well, something about this didn't pass the smell test for me, though. And so I started having problems trying to figure out a way to chip away and see if this was true, and I could not. And so one day we decided we were going to go find this homeowner. And we went and looking and we ultimately found this house. And I left a card for the homeowner to call me, and the homeowner calls me and says, and I said, oh yeah, you probably don't remember this, but it was a while ago, but there was a woman that came by your house one night and she was pretty traumatized because she had gone through this robbery and I'm just trying to find out why you wouldn't let her call the police. And this woman, it was like an old woman, she started cracking up and she said, wouldn't let her call the police. I begged that woman to call the police. She didn't want to call the police. She wanted to call her friend. Anyway, I find out that this woman isn't really telling the truth. And so I shared that name of that witness with the defense. Seems to me that's what I should have done. But it was quite a big deal to the defense bar that I had given that name of that witness, because that witness was basically going to discredit my victim of this crime. And when I gave this name to the defense bar, when I gave it to the defense attorney, he was quite shocked that I had done that. The point was that I didn't want to give the name. So we're all clear here. I didn't want to tell the defense that there was this witness out there that was going to completely dismantle my victim. But because I think I had begun to practice with this awareness of paying attention to the conduct of that was showing up, regardless of whether it was good, bad, or indifferent, then I gave the name first without the secondary thoughts about it. I gave the name in relation to my practice on the conduct and not about what I would have preferred. In some respects, that's what this second practice is about. It's about just paying attention to conduct, regardless of whether you think that conduct should be good or bad. There's one last practice, and that's this kind of what I would call a purification practice. And this purification practice is, I don't know if you guys know, but there's two words, Hiri and Otapa, that are Pali words. Hiri and Otapa are two words that they don't really have an English word for it. So Hiri is the sense of shame that we get, and Otapa is the sense of fear that we get around wrongdoing. So the way they're described is consciousness, or it's like our conscious, or it's described as the guardian of the guardians of the world. They're also called the Devadhammas, and the last one is celestial qualities. You might question that, celestial qualities. I want to tell you the example that they use to explain Hiri and Otapa. The way they help us understand what it is they say, imagine a steel rod. On one end, there's excrement smeared on it. That would be the Hiri end. And the other end is like a red hot, like a red hot burning side of it. And that would be the Otapa. The Hiri side is the side that has a natural disgust that you would have if you grab a hold of the side that has the excrement on it. There's like a natural sense of that would happen. The Otapa side is the side that would draw away sort of this fear of getting burned if you grab the end that has the red hot side of it. These two natural places actually help purify a lot of our conduct. It actually helps us begin to see and to pay attention to our conduct, because we either feel this kind of pulling away or the of disgust that comes on the Hiri side, or we have a sense of fear in doing something wrong because of the consequences that come from karma and wrongful behavior has a consequence that we eventually will pay for. So these two energies are what helps us stay aligned. Another way to think about it is Hiri is like an inner shame at the thought of doing something wrong. It's an inner reaction, not wanting to do something wrong, whether it's open or in secret. There's a sense that I don't want to do something, and that we know we can't hide it from ourselves. Otapa is the fear of doing something wrong, so it's an awareness that of the inevitable consequence of karma. But neither Hiri nor Otapa are judgments. There's a societal judgment, though. There's a societal way that we judge behavior. There's a societal sense of shame and a societal sense of fear in conduct that's more based in guilt than anything else. And it's being aware of the distinction between that guilty conscious and Hiri and Otapa. I think I want to read this. Joseph said that guilt is a manifestation of condemnation or aversion towards oneself, which does not understand the changing, transformative quality of mind. So guilt is sort of this kind of blaming of oneself. But I want to read this thing that Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote about Hiri and Otapa. It says, in the present day world, with its secularization of all values, such notions as shame and fear of wrong are bound to appear antiquated relics from a puritanical past. When superstition and dogma minacled our rights to inhibit self-expression. Yet the Buddha's stress on the importance of Hiri and Otapa was based on a deep insight into the different potentialities of human nature. He saw that the path to deliverance is a struggle against the current, and that if we are to unfold the mind's capacities for wisdom, purity, and peace, then we need to keep the powder keg of the defilements under the watchful eye of diligent sentinels. The project of self-cultivation, which the Buddha proclaims as the means to liberation from suffering, requires that we keep a critical watch over the movements of our mind, both on occasions when they motivate bodily and verbal deeds, when they remain inwardly absorbed with their own preoccupations. Oh, and when they remain inwardly absorbed with their own preoccupations. To exercise such a self-scrutiny is an aspect of heedfulness, which the Buddha states is the path to the deathless. In the practice of self-examination, the sense of shame and fear of wrongdoing play a critical role. So this might sound a little strange. This might sound even borderline on what? But one way that I begin to practice Hiri and Otapa is by trying to do something wrong. So I grew up with a lot of shame and judgment and a lot of fear around conduct. So I have a natural inclination towards societal shame and fear. But that's not Hiri and Otapa. It's a different kind of sense of shame and fear. And so practicing in such a way that you can begin to feel that as sentinels to help us sort of become a compass around our behavior. For me, the best way to practice it is to begin to try to do something I know is wrong. Just the idea of trying to do something that I knew would be wrong is far more, I could feel this Hiri and Otapa far more closely and more realistically than the self-judgment that would come if I noticed I did something wrong. Does this make sense? If I noticed I did something wrong, I would have this mind that would immediately go to guilt and punishment for look at what I had done wrong. But when I would go into a grocery store and just think about stealing something. That's all I got. I ain't got to steal nothing. I just had to think about it. And that thought alone would create this internal sense of I'm going to get in trouble. Right? That is what I would look for. That sense of trying to reestablish my true connection with Hiri and Otapa, and not from this traumatized way of hating myself for wrong conduct. Because if you come from a world like I did, Hiri and Otapa can get stuck in that gray area of guilt and shame. And that's not really what this purification practice is all about. This purification practice is more pointed towards an internal compass that helps us see when we are internal. It's like an internal gauge for the Hiri, that sense of shame, and an external gauge for the Otapa, for the fear of doing wrong. And so I would begin, I practiced doing little things, putting myself in situations where I would begin to question with, you know, that idea of doing something wrong. So I want to leave you. So next week, we're going to actually start talking about the implications of these things, these three practices. I'm hoping that you'll try to look into one or all three of them over the course of the week to see if you can see the difference in the two and the difference in the three and how each one points to virtuous conduct from a different way. But then next week we're going to talk about the implications of it, how it is that when we start practicing with these three different ways of embodying virtue, what happens to us in the long run. So I want to leave you with Dhammadasa. He says, those who read books cannot understand the teachings, and what's more, may even go astray. But those who try to observe the things going on in the mind and always take that which is true in their own minds as their standards never get muddled. They are able to comprehend suffering and ultimately will understand Dharma. Then they will understand the books they read. So let's just sit for a little bit here. Okay, so if somebody has a question or comment about your own practice around virtue. The question's whether I was saying that my purification practice on Hiri and Otapa was to think about doing something wrong or actually do something wrong. It was the thinking about it. But I mean, I got pretty close before I could actually feel into the sense of, it's easy when you think about taking something out of a store because that is so... it's so readily wrongdoing. But sometimes things that I would say, I would try to see if I could say something in a mean way, and I'd almost have to get the words out before I'd even begin to feel a sense of shame or fear that I'm doing something wrong. But it's I know it seems strange, but it was the only way that I could not get trapped in my old patterns of guilt and shame around behavior and just have a healthy sense of this idea that Hiri and Otapa would be guardians and not, that it's a celestial energy, a deva kind of energy and not the usual guilt and shame that I was always trapped in. Do you see? So sometimes I would have to actually get some words out that were harmful, you know, on purpose, just to try to see if I could feel into this as being a gift for me and not just more beating over the head. And it's not, Hiri and Otapa, it does not have a beating aspect to it at all. It does not have a sense of, there you go again, or I can't believe you're doing that. There's no guilt, there's none of that. It's if you could say it, it's a clean feeling of shame. It's a clean feeling of fear of wrongdoing. Or cleaner, I guess you could say it like that. Blameless is more like that. Yes?
But lots of times it happens that Todd comes in doing something wrong, and because of the fear, one doesn't do it.
That's right. Yes, it's the same thing. That's the same thing it is. But what I was pointing to was, if you happen to have some thought that comes through and the thought alone is enough for you to have fear of wrongdoing, then that's great. But if you tend to be self-critical, then what that would end up being is me beating myself up for thinking that in the first place. And so many times, as a way to contrast that trauma way of responding to things, I would set an intention to practice something on purpose, just to help myself see that I'm doing a practice and I'm not just there I go again doing some terrible thing. Yes. It is.
I have that experience a lot, like answering an email when I'm a little irritated, and I know suddenly I get the feeling.
Yes.
And I know I'm being paid to be passive aggressive.
Yes.
This nice little sentence I put together isn't nice at all.
Yes. 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 That's it. Yes. So it's, she's saying that she notices. She gets that little twinge inside, and you feel it, and you kind of know this is not okay. You kind of get that sense of it, right? And so there's a natural arising of this that happens with Hiri and Otapa. That's why I think the Buddha called them gifts, because there's a natural arising of it that happens automatically, that has nothing to do with how I was raised or whether I was raised good or bad or whether I'm a good person or a bad person. It's the natural arising of that internal twinge in the body that says, you might not want to send that. You might want to sleep on that. But I have a way, when you come from trauma, there's a way that we can take even that natural inclination towards Hiri and Otapa and sully it a bit by making it somehow or another as a hammer to beat myself over the head yet again, watching all that behavior. And so one way to help myself feel into that twinge without the subsequent beating myself up about it was to begin to actually practice this idea that I'm going to watch the twinge of wrongdoing. So what I was doing is creating a practice so I know that I am intentionally bringing up this question you know, this energy, that feeling, intentionally, not to send the email, but just to feel it so that I could begin to get to know that these are two sentinel practices that are designed for purification. And they turn into like compasses to help us see how to line our conduct up so that we're not necessarily, you know, just out there doing whatever without any without paying attention. Because the other thing, just speaking from somebody who comes from trauma, the other side of our, the traumatic behavior that we have that we don't like to talk about very much, is that because we are so quick to beat ourselves up and punish ourselves for behavior, we have a tendency to just let ourselves do all this harmful conduct and chalk it off as that's just the way, that's because I come from all that trauma. So I would do so much harm with so many people, and my initial thoughts were just sort of like, well, you know, I come from so much trauma, that's just the way I am. This is the way it is. I don't mean any harm, but you know, it's just the way it is. And I would kind of blow off harmful conduct. So either I'm blowing it off and not giving it much credence at all, just kind of a flippantness about it, or I am in this rigid kind of, I can't believe I'm doing this, pounding upon me about it. And so in order to let these Hiri and Otapa be actual purification practices which actually line up a compass, realign you with a sense of personal integrity, then I did it as a practice on purpose so that I could see what it is that I was doing. Do you see that? That's the difference between just letting it arise and doing it on purpose. So, yeah, all the way in the back first. Give an example of that. So, a way to think of, a way to notice it is, okay, this would be a perfect example, since I do it even still today. I have a little saying at my house that says, same old slippers, same old rice, same old glimpse at paradise. And so every time I walk around the house, I can see this little saying that's always there. So when I said, when we started, same old crowd, my mind was thinking same old slipper, same old rice, same old glimpse of paradise. And it's kind of just a random little statement. But somehow I got embarrassed when I said it, right, out loud. So when I'm sitting here, my natural inclination is to begin to complain to myself continuously about how could I say that. And I have this way of noticing when the mind starts doing that all the time, saying that all the time, and just actually apologize, say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be so disruptive. I tell myself, oh, I'm sorry, I don't mean to disrupt my city with this grumbling. You know, it's sort of like a way of helping me say, just like if I were saying it out loud, I would say, oh, I'm sorry, I don't mean to disrupt your sit. So I don't mean to disrupt my sit either. And it's so that's what you're doing. You're actually telling yourself, you're actually seeing that the things you say to yourself or the things that you do to yourself is just as harmful to you as it is to someone else. So what you're doing is apologizing to yourself for causing harm. And that's exactly what you do. You just say, I'm sorry. I don't mean to cause harm. I don't mean to cause you harm. I don't mean to interrupt my sit. I don't mean to go on and on and on about that and just have that sense of making amends for causing yourself pain. Once you notice it, because, you know, you may not even notice it, but until you, when you notice it, that's when you want to apologize and make amends. So that's really what it is, just making amends to yourself for whatever you've said. On purpose. Okay. Good. Did you have
something? Oh, yeah, I'd just like to hear a little bit more about when you were talking about the hearing and the code. What is it?
Otapa.
Mm-hmm. So, what's the difference between that embodiment versus like just noticing, like in sitting meditation, when we're sensing, you know, the sense? So, like, what is it? What is enough? Just noticing that you have that, or would you incur, would you say to actually kind of spread it out a little
more? I'm lost. I mean, noticing the feelings of. Of Hiri and Otapa? Yes. Right.
So, my question to you is, as a teacher, is it sufficient to just notice that, or do, should I go deeper into that noticing?
So the right, so the question is, spoken after my true heart. <That's>, so the question is, what's sufficient? Is noticing sufficient, or do we need to go deeper into it, right? And actually, I would say you don't need to do anything more than notice, that noticing is sufficient. It's watching what you do when you notice the pain. That's what I'm saying about people that come from trauma. When they feel the pain of the natural arising of her Hiri or Otapa, there is an inclination to punish ourselves because we notice something bad. It feels like it. You know, it feels like I did something wrong. Or that's right.
Yeah.
But you want to feel that. That's right. So instead of flipping it off, which the mind can just distract myself and just be like, okay, I'm not going to see that. Because I do so much wrong, I just don't even want to see it anymore. Or I can be on this aggressive punishing myself because I feel or notice this shame or this sense of wrongdoing, right? So what you're trying to do is to practice intentionally feeling that and just stay with that awareness, that knowing that there is a sense of wrongness here, a sense of wrongdoing, a sense of shame about the idea that I would do something wrong, or a sense of a fear that I'm about doing something wrong.
And so basically it's just you're continuing the practice of awareness, of mindful awareness.
That's right, by feeling it.
It's not doing anything to it, it's just noticing it, letting it touch there, and then,
That's right. Right, because you're trying to notice it as a gift, because the gift of noticing Hiri and Otapa is that it's not about you. It's not a judgment on you. It's a natural arising that is human. That's a natural That's why it's called a Devadhamma. It's an awareness or a practice that helps us see the boundaries of virtue that comes naturally being human. It's the gift that we are given. But it gets distorted if you come from trauma. It gets distorted into, we don't get to enjoy the true qualities of Hiri and Otapa because we get too caught in the getting mad at ourselves because we feel it in the first place, or the flippantness of it and just letting it just pretend like we didn't see that we just, you know.
So basically you're personalizing it somewhat. You can't personalize it with your story.
Yes. Yeah. But you're you don't want to personalize it though. You want to just feel it as a awareness practice. You don't have to do anything about it. You just have to feel it. That the awareness of it, the embodied feeling of it, the awareness of it itself, and the sensing into it is sufficient to help you see and begin to understand where the line is around integrity. It is sufficient in and of itself if you just let yourself feel it without all the judgment that gets attached to it. That's what worries me. That's what difficulty I had around Hiri and Otapa, because of my natural inclination towards getting mad at myself for doing something wrong. Can you see that? So we're practicing in a way to help us see it differently. Okay, so it's time for us to stop. Thank you so much for your practice, and I hope you'll try these three ways of practicing around virtue and see what happens for you. See what actually shows up for you, where you have difficulty and where you, what works best for you, what helps you see the natural arising of virtuous conduct.